I'm Kamaran Peter of the Center for Analytics and Behavioral Change. I'm also in the Alan Gray Center for Values-Based Leadership at the Graduate School of Business, the University of Cape Town. You're listening to The Pulse. Today, I'm sitting here with two distinguished guests. Heather Robertson is the editor of the Data Maverick 168, the print version. She's also the former editor of The Herald and The Weekend Post. She was deputy editor at The Sunday Times and Elle Magazine as well. Also with us is Herman Wassermann, who is Professor of Media Studies at the University of Cape Town. Both our guests have had illustrious careers and possess a deep understanding of the media. And we're together today to discuss the role of the media and social media during periods of intense civil protest and unrest. So first, you know, just a more general question for the benefit of our listeners. With respect to the devastating scale of unrest that we've seen unfold in KwaZulu-Natal. Why is this happening? Who benefits and who will lose out because of what's transpiring right now? And in particular, to what extent does this represent support for Jacob Zuma? And to what extent is this a product of the deep inequality and grinding poverty that's been exacerbated under COVID-19 conditions? Heather.
Look, I think the riots and the looting and the violence are definitely symptomatic of the social conditions that we have, of the gross inequality in South Africa. And I've been writing about this for quite a while now, that unless that is addressed, this is a powder keg that is going to explode. But make no mistake, the radical economic transformation faction and Jacob Zuma's supporters have actually, are involved and have manipulated and taken advantage and pretty opportunistically of the deep inequalities that we have. And so yes, the match was lit by the people who were hanging outside the Nkandla compound mansion. And then they did very little on the night when Zuma was actually, you know, handed himself in at Escort Correctional Services. But they had planned and the violence and started, you know, it was like little fires all over the place on Friday night. Yes, fanned a lot by social media So I think the cause is it's both. I don't think it's only support of the Jacob Zuma and the Free Jacob Zuma movement. I do think that it massively increased and spread because of poverty, hunger, and the levels of unemployment. I mean, we have, I think, a lot of lumpen proletariat out there. I mean, it's very interesting that it was liquor stores that the last two weeks we've had liquor not being sold because of level 4 of lockdown. I think there's a lot of frustration because of lockdown. People not being able to move around. I mean, people just hurtful of this pandemic and being frustrated about it. I mean, people have lost their jobs due to the pandemic. People have lost lives due to the pandemic. People have been very ill due to the pandemic. So I think it's a conflation of a whole lot of different factors that were lit by the people standing outside, you know, at Nkandla, and it's just blown up.
It's like the perfect firestorm. All the fuel was there, and all it took was, you know, a little bit of, not a little bit, I think quite a bit of coordinators.
Yeah, no, I think there's a massive coordination. Speaking to people on the ground, there does seem to be a coordinated response. Understand that, I mean, that Jacob Zuma was in charge of this apparatus, not just for the 9 years that he was president, but remember he had a massive, he was part of the negotiations, the peace negotiations in KwaZulu-Natal in the early days in the 90s. I mean, who was he negotiating with? He was negotiating with warlords. I mean, how did he pacify the warlords? Did the warlords support him in the end? Because, I mean, there was a massive shift between the IFP and the ANC when Jacob Zuma came into power. I mean, you know, so those, you know, who knows? But it's a very complex situation, and I think it's been happening longer than the 10 years that Jacob Zuma was president. And those of us who grew up in KwaZulu-Natal have experienced this violence before. Before it was the ANC, the UDF versus the IFP, but then also a ZAPA thrown in. So how much of that has actually, you know, been lying dormant or has been activated and has been rekindled now? It's very complex, but what wasn't there was social media. That's one element that wasn't there. Has been social media and how that spreads disinformation. I mean, I've been appalled at the WhatsApp messages. We must go and burn down every single minister's house. We must kill Cyril Ramaphosa in his house. We know where he lives. This is a WhatsApp in isiZulu in a Yovel group. Okay, that I'm talking about. I mean, unable to identify who the person is, but it's like it's incendiary. But it's happening, and it's all over the place, and in all different platforms.
Yeah, I grew up in KwaZulu-Natal in the 80s, so I lived through the two states of emergency, and just drawing on my own personal experience, what's happening now was kind of what the nightmare scenario would be in KZN. And, you know, it's not good to draw out all ghosts, but I think what you're saying is really speaks to the heart of the issue, which goes back quite a long way. Even the IFP only really came into CODESA negotiations at a very late stage. They had to be convinced. There was all this talk of secession. So even though it might be denied, I think there's also elements of sort of Zulu ethno-nationalism playing some role here. Herman, I know it's not your stock in trade, but do you have anything to add to this?
Well, I think just to add on to what Heather has already said, I think the temptation in moments like these is to try and find some sort of causal relationship between what we see on the ground and you know, to connect events. And I think one has to guard against a sort of reductionist view of this. And I think what I appreciate from both your views is that you both take it not only back to the sort of longer history of what's going on in KwaZulu-Natal now and the 80s and so on, the long-standing tensions, polarizations in that province, but also the broader issues of this is certainly a powder keg that was lit by the imprisonment of Jacob Zuma and his supporters, but that there are also many other factors at play. There are social, political, and economic factors. And I think it's that the challenge here is to try and unpack how these things relate and avoid, I think, a simplistic view of this. So what we see here, I think, is certainly a political moment, and it is also something that is maybe a useful moment for certain political players and political actors, but it is certainly also something a more deeper and longer, more complex. And again, I think also when we talk about something like looting or rioting or unrest, and maybe we should get to some of these terms, in due course of this conversation, and also how the media are using these terms. But I think when we look at this, there's also the danger that one homogenizes what is happening. I mean, there are different types of protest, different types of criminality, different types of looting, different types of behavior, I think, and then we have to try and disaggregate these. I think it's quite a complex situation, and it's a very demanding one, I think, especially for the media to get to grips with and to try and portray. And I think already we are seeing some of the problematic aspects of whenever there's a conflict, whenever there's, something that is a crisis like this, tends to lead to certain types of reporting that might be more harmful than good, and so maybe we can get into some of that as well in due course.
Yeah, now that you raise it,
I was struck by some of the language on ENCA that was being used throughout the last few days. You know, pronouncing judgment in essence, you know, not incorrectly calling this criminality. But when the media uses that kind of language, it's definitely shaping the conversation in a particular way. And, you know, particularly referencing, this is not protest, this is criminality. And, you know, also just speaking to the broader history of this on a more South African scale, is that service delivery protests, what we, there's a wide range of different reasons for these protests. We lump them under this term service delivery protests. But to some sources, you know, in 2004, we only had like 14 major service delivery protests, ones that went violent. There are different sources for this, by the way, you know, so it's hard to pin it down. But from this particular source, it went from about 14 major in 2004 to peaking at over 100 in 2009. Which is just after the financial collapse and Jacob Zuma comes to power. And then around 2013 to 2014, it actually started peaking around 400 per year. And I was monitoring this all along and became deeply concerned about particularly the youth bulge who were being raised in this culture of protest, which is the only way they could, often those communities had legitimately worked with local councillors and local government as much as they could and got nowhere. And after 2 or 3 years, they would become hurtful and just, you know, take over a highway or, you know, set up obstacles and basically render it ungovernable. And then a politician would come in and see to their needs. So it's setting a precedent for how you go about doing it. So I've always had this fear that it might spread in the way that it did in KwaZulu-Natal, but never in my wildest nightmares did I imagine I'd see what I've been seeing over the last 4 days.
I think that the point here is that, again, that is important how media frame things. And again, just at the beginning of this these events a few days ago, I think the first framing was that of protest. So, I mean, and I think international media as well were often saying this is a protest against Zuma's imprisonment. And immediately that made me feel somewhat uncomfortable just because of the language of or the history of protest that you've just pointed to, where that sort of protest, the social liberty protest, is also a reductionist way of looking at it, because it's not only about giving us some sort of, you know, in a sort of transactional move, giving us social services or, you know, delivering whatever that might be, water or sanitation, all of that important, but pointing to a much larger problem, which is that there are many communities that felt that they weren't being heard, communities that felt that they weren't being, they're not important, they're not in count. And the only way that either the politicians or the media could pay attention to them was by blocking roads and burning things, to put it bluntly. But that was a much more, I would say, and I don't want to get into the language of legitimacy or not, but I mean, I think it was a political and a longer political struggle. And there were also some political groupings that have come out of those protests and have been linked to those protests in a way that I think one could see them as democratization protests, you know, and we've studied this and we've written about this, and it was interesting. I think that a lot of those protests were to do with the dividends of democracy, people that felt that the dividends of democracy weren't paid to them, right? So nothing really has changed. And it also pointed not only to a political failure, but often also a failure on the part of the media, that the media only reported when there are these moments of conflict, these spikes, and it became a strategy, right? So, and when we spoke to activists, they would say, well, that's the only way that we can get the media to report on this. And when they do, they only report on this while things are happening. Once the protest stops, then they disappear. And I think so to come back to this particular set of moments, I think when I saw the term protest, I think this was, for me, felt uncomfortable, because it might have the implication that it is similar to those types of protest, which I don't think it is. I think there are certainly some resonances, and I think some of what we are seeing certainly speaks to a disgruntlement, a disillusionment, a frustration, and an anger, and maybe a lack of ownership of society, a feeling of marginalization. But it is not, I think, a political protest in the sense that those community protests were as a sort of outflow of the democratization process. So I think that has now subsequently been reframed. I think the media now talk about unrest and similar type of framings. And so it is important to, I think, that we consider also how this is framed and how this is reported. And again, trying to do the difficult work of making this more complex rather than simplifying it. And I think that is a particular challenge for the media, is to try and get to the complexities rather than oversimplifying things.
You raise such an interesting point. Hannah Arendt, in one of her books, quotes John Locke, if I'm correct, where he speaks about the plight of the poor man. And what he says is, you know, what the real curse of the poor man is invisibility. And so it speaks to, you know, that making yourself visible in order to become part of, to get some of the dividends of this democracy.
There was an interesting piece of research that Carl von Halt did from CSVR, The Smoke That Calls, which speaks to exactly this. He looked at 8 cases of community protests and xenophobic violence. And it's exactly that, is that the media goes when there's burning tires and when there's fires, but not just that. And when the media goes, that's when government pays attention. And so we need to look at it in that context as well. It's like smoke signals calling. You know, to actually look at us, pay attention to us, take our issues seriously. And this is the only time we do. It's a failing of a media that has been decimated for numerous reasons. I mean, there are much fewer journalists in newsrooms around, and so they can't actually attend to everything. But obviously, also a failure of government to pay attention to service delivery in those areas. So this is the only way of communities communicating whatever their needs or their issues are.
Yeah, it's a strategy. So my next question is, you know, the right to protest is key to a healthy democracy. And while civil disobedience is often a part of protest, you know, the role of violence is heavily contested. And in the media and social media climate of today, simply sharing footage of violence can itself add fuel to the fire. So when we look at the protests unfolding over the past 4 days, what can we say about the role of media and social media in amplifying the spread of violence? So both the media and social media. And more specifically, to what extent does traditional media amplify the disinformation that appears on social media or serve as a source of disinformation itself? Is there a vicious cycle between the two that can amplify the unrest? I know it's a bit of a leading question.
Okay, so when we talk about the media, we've got to talk of different kinds of media, okay? I would like to think that the media that basically puts itself and the media, that those media organizations who are members of, for example, the South African Press Council, or the Broadcasting Complaints Commission, those media that actually put themselves up for peer review and scrutiny, in general, are a little bit more, or I think a lot more careful about amplifying falsehoods and do a lot more fact checking. I mean, I know in the Daily Maverick, we have to do that, and in other organizations that I've worked for, we did do that as well. It's very easy to, you know, for organizations which are looking to increase audience so as to increase advertising, to not be circumspect and to not investigate and verify and fact check. And I'm just going to call a spade a spade. IL, an independent media, they deserted the press council. They've decided to have their own ombudsman, and look what's happened with that. The story of the decupits. An editor working for IL actually wrote a story that went viral globally, and we still haven't seen those babies, and they're investigating themselves. It is a bit of a leading question, and it's very difficult, and what we have to do in the media is to take very deep breaths and do not want to go and cover every single thing and do not amplify every single thing that we see on Twitter or on Facebook, but we have to actually check that first. And some, as I said, who are chasing clicks to increase audience size or they would perpetuate the falsehoods that are being amplified on social media. But I think what does distinguish those of us who do belong to organizations like the Press Council and who do abide by the press code, it does distinguish, we are forced to actually, and even when we make mistakes, we are forced to self-correct, to apologize, to publish prominently those apologies. So, and I think that is a very valuable mechanism for us, and for it to be totally seeped in the way we actually do our work, on all levels, particularly in times like this. And then the conversations in the newsrooms, there's a lot of argument and a lot of debate about you can see, because we're working remotely, right, because of COVID. Very difficult to actually physically go into places. Our reporters and photographers are putting themselves at great risk. They have to be covered in PPE, and now in situations of violence, they have to wear protective gear. But they are going out there and they're getting the photographs and they're interviewing people involved. But often in very, very difficult circumstances. And then so it's up to us that are sitting at the desk to ask the hard questions and to verify and to fact check and to counter check, And I think online, I really, really take my hat off to Africa Check. They've been very fast in for example, that Dudu Zile Zuma tweet. Saying that, now she's like saluting all these people protesting over the place, and they pointed out that actually, that this doesn't actually happen now. This happened a year ago. And I really think media, then they are part of the media, like Africa Check, are doing a brilliant job to basically counter the false narratives that are being, spread all over the place by who knows who. We don't know if they're bots, we don't know if they're real people, And then the few real journalists who are not bots. It's a tough job. It's a very tough job that we have, working in a pandemic and working in these kinds of circumstances. So we try, is what I'm trying to say. Is those of us in the media that do subscribe to the values of the press code and do belong to the press councils, the broadcast code, and do abide by those things, we try damn hard to get it right. And when we get it wrong, we self-correct and apologize. And that's very important.
Yeah, I can imagine what a difficult job it is. I just watched a little YouTube interview with William Byrd, and he was saying, in the era of mobile phones, journalists can't be first on the scene everywhere. So they take on a different role of actually having to vet the kind of footage that's coming through.
We don't break the news. We have to verify the news. We have to go in deeper. Especially when there's a crisis like this, and I mean, it happens everywhere. There's a temptation to like, oh no, we've got to actually go and do this and do this first and be there. And we've got to constantly caution and say, hold on, this is not our role anymore. All the stuff is flying all over the place by, I call them citizen journalists, but ordinary members of the public with their cell phones who are like sharing stuff all over the place. We have got to step back and we've got to actually try and understand it, speak to experts, try and join the dots, try and explain what's behind what's happening, because we do not break news anymore. However, I mean, I know News24 claims to break news first, but actually it's the citizens who are breaking news. It's cell phones and smartphones have put that breaking news role, the history maker. They say the first record of history. It's actually ordinary people, and journalists can't be everywhere because, as I said, we've been decimated. What we can do is actually use the tools that we've been using, that we've learned, to try and distill, analyze, explain, interrogate, investigate. That's what we can do.
So if I can come in there, I think what you've been referring to now in terms of the curatorial job of journalists, I think that's certainly an added challenge, I think, that we see on social media. And that's the whole disinformation and fact checking, and it's a whole new ball game, I think, for journalists. But I think there is also a longer tradition of these questions in terms of what's the role of media in terms of amplifying violence, and then there's a whole school of thought. You know, you can go back to Thatcher and Northern Ireland, where she used those terms of the oxygen of publicity. So don't give protesters the oxygen of publicity. A similar argument, you might recall, was used by Claudio Motsuneng a few years ago when he said the SABC was not allowed to cover community protests. And often these arguments are often used by people that want to quell conflict, but actually want to suppress dissent. And I think that's the wrong way to go. But the converse is true in the sense, and so there's a whole academic history also of media effects, and you know, to what extent can media actually amplify and cause further violence. That's another classic, you know. So I think that is certainly not the way to go. But at the same time, there's also the danger that one says, well, we are just mirroring what is going on. We're just the messenger. We're just holding up a mirror to society. And I think the points that Heather, that you're making around ethics and around responsibility, that is absolutely vital in a situation like this. So there's also a whole tradition of peace journalism, for instance, where instead of reporting on, and Heather, I know that while you were at the Herald, you did also this listening, for instance, and that's a very good example of a type of peace journalism, that listening to communities and trying to look for solutions rather than just playing up the conflict. And I think what we're seeing here already is that there's a danger of reporting this almost as a sort of a horse race. You know, who's going to win? You know, the looters or the police, or the Zuma or Ramaphosa? And you know, it's like this. And just reporting on that, and in almost in a stenographic fashion, that I do think has the potential of, if not amplifying the violence, actually not doing anything to contribute to its de-escalation. I think what is needed here is then that sort of ethical reflection on how can we make this maybe more understandable for people? How can we contextualize this? Because remember, I mean, as widespread as this is in KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng, we are still talking about two provinces in a country. We are also talking about and to what extent are we seeing people not only resorting to vigilantism, but also, you know, people actually standing up and say, well, we're going to protect the shops, we're going to try and help out, we're going to try and... So there's always a choice, and I think there's always a choice of what do you spotlight. So that argument of we're holding up a mirror, I think, is a useless metaphor for me. I think one should rather talk about projecting. What are you projecting? So you do choose to focus on certain things and project certain things. And I think that's where the ethical responsibility comes in, to realize that we are not just recording and mirroring. We are actually contributing to a conversation or to maybe maybe it's long past the conversation, you're contributing to a very heated argument. So what can the media do to de-escalate this, to contextualize this, to explain this? And I think this is where this knowledge of history, of longer histories, of social dynamics, of also of the sort of things that we've been talking about, the longer history of democratization in this country, the frustration that's palpable everywhere. How do we explain that? Rather than just looking at this as a sort of very simplistic conflict that, you know, you follow as if it's a dumpster fire. So I think for me, I think that's where the ethical questions comes in, and I think Heather is entirely correct by saying that the press code, the press council, the Broadcasting Complaints Commission, these and also the various organizations working to counter disinformation, these are vitally important at this point, because this is really where journalism and really all of us that are involved with it as media users and people that share things on WhatsApp and on Facebook, Twitter, and so on, where we get to reflect on what we're doing. And if we don't have that, I think then the media is going to do more harm than good. So it's really a vital aspect. And I share your concern, Heather, that, some parts of the media have just really decided they're not going to do that. And that's really problematic. At the same time, I think another thing around journalism that we have to recognize is that it has been hollowed out. The capabilities of the media have been vastly eroded over the past number of years as a result of many factors and economic factors that have been exacerbated also now by the pandemic. And we saw the SANEF report that came out a few months ago that pointed to the some of these problems that are still present in newsrooms. So I think, again, here, when we talk about the media's role, there's also this is also a chance to think about how do we strengthen the media's capabilities to contribute to the sort of peace building and peace journalism rather than just the sort of stenography of violence.
How well are journalists being prepared to be able to bring real perspective to the very complex kind of challenges we face as a society, complex interactions that produce, the events that capture our attention, beyond just the business model of media and how it's changed, just in terms of how journalists are prepared, have there been any fundamental changes or shortcomings in it?
You know, the biggest problem has been for me in newsrooms and in institutions that I've worked for example, has been the closing down of training in newsrooms due to economic factors. As the institutions started making less profits and media started shrinking and more people were let go. So one of the first things to go there used to be cadet training, and there used to be internal schools where young journalists would come in that say come from the universities, and then they'd work and be mentored by older journalists. And now, people have to multitask so much. They've got to use their cell phones to take photographs. They've got to record. They've got to tweet. They've got to write their stories. They've got to interview. I think that's that burden, that overburdening of the journalist as an individual, and that taking away of that mentorship role of older and younger, because also newsrooms have become rather juniorized, and Telemaverick is like an anomaly, because actually there are more people over 60 than under 30, which I think it does show in terms of analysis, etc., and understanding of history and context and background. But a lot of newsrooms have been juniorized because the older journalists were more expensive. So this is the challenge that newsrooms face, and in terms of the universities, I recently did my MA at Rhodes. I find the universities are trying. They are actually trying to. When I did my MA, the roads must fall and fees must fall were happening, and the lectures and academics there really did try, and I found we used a lot of we used a lot of Herman's work papers and academics and media researchers from all around the country. I think the academics are actually doing a pretty good job of analyzing the role of media and the transformation and the use of digital media. I mean, honestly, I'm saying from the perspective of someone who was a master's student, I was amazed, having come out of the industry, at the amount of work that there's been done in terms of reflecting on the role of journalism, digital media, the whole digital transformation. So when I, as a student, I felt that the universities were preparing people. That was at a master's level. But what I do think needs to happen is that there needs to be better relationship between people working in the industry and the academy. When I was at the Herald, I had quite a good relationship with Rhodes, and I would speak to students, and I think that was fantastic, because as like my colleague Sabun Galwa, who was the editor of the Dispatch at the time, we'd be called in and we'd engage with students. I think that's important. Our journalists would also go and talk. So having that, bringing in the practical experience and engaging with engagements between students in the academy, lectures in the academy, and working journalists and editors, I think it's very important. Otherwise, students come, with a whole lot of theoretical knowledge, which I'm not saying, which is important, but not understanding the pressures and the context of actually working in the field. And understanding the multifaceted roles that journalists play. You know, we're not just watchdogs. Like Herman said, we do sometimes do listening journalism, you know, trying to have solutions journalism, and just to get exposed to those different kinds and forms of journalism. There's the whole school of leisure journalism. It's not just naming and shaming and exposing and then moving on to the next naming and shaming and exposing. There are many different roles that we play. And so I do think there needs to be, we need to solidify the relationship between the academy and working journalists, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if I can come in, I think it's a long-standing debate, of course, between academic journalism or journalism studies and practitioners. And, you know, from an academic point of view, we often think that, you know, we're asked to view the practice as normative. In other words, we have to prepare people to go into practice, whereas we would also like the reverse to be true, in a way, to say that journalists who also, you know, pay more attention to what research is being done. And you know, that's why it's always great to have journalists like Heather and others coming back and doing their MAs and telling us also what is the realities out there and vice versa. But I think what is undoubtedly true, and that is that the technology has sped up things so much that the pressures are immense. And I think this is both true of what I can see from practice, but also certainly from the educational point of view, is that there's often the demand then also to say that get the technology right first. I mean, you have to be able to do podcasts, video casts, clips, do all of that technology stuff. And there's almost that fetishization of delivery of beautiful media products, right? Often people also say we're producing content. I mean, they're not even saying being journalism, we're producing content. Whereas I think that language betrays something of a sort of mindset of, you know, it's the product that is important, not the process. Whereas I think the process, we have to claw back a bit and say the process has to be maybe sometimes slowed down a little bit. And again, we see this now in this context where there's so much happening so fast. And it's all over social media, it's all over television, it's on our WhatsApps, and everything seems to be happening so fast that and journalists have this instinct, and I think it's mostly important as well to try and stay on top of what is happening. But I think there is certainly also a parallel demand, and that is to say, well, let's just pause a little bit and think about what is happening, and as things are unfolding, try and also make sense of them. And I think that's where there's also interestingly another movement. You know, we've talked about solutions journalism and peace journalism. But there's also a movement saying about slow journalism, which is counterintuitive, right? Because journalism is that first draft of history. It's history in a hurry. It's always that fast paced. But saying that, you know, the role, and this is to come back to, Heather, what you've said right at the beginning about journalists as curators, to say that, you know, all of that fast moving stuff is already out there. You can't really hope to keep up with it. What you can do as a journalist is to try and make sense of it and contextualize it and add meaning to it and let people, you know, think about it maybe a bit more slowly. So I think there's these, I don't want to say they're competing imperatives. I would rather say they're parallel imperatives of reporting, doing it on technology, doing it fast, bringing the news out there in all these various formats that you're required to do, but at the same time, also doing the slow work of meaning making, of explaining, of contextualization. And I think that's where, if we come back to education, where certainly in the department where I am, you know, that's the way that we think about what we're doing is not only, and maybe not even as much as some other places are doing the technology and the practical stuff, saying what we're also wanting journalists or would-be journalists to develop is that sense of imagination and also a sense of moral imagination. So, and Kamaran, you mentioned Martha Nussbaum earlier. She wrote a beautiful little book on the humanities. It's called Not for Profit. In that book, she talks about the importance of humanities, because what she says, if you're reading a novel, if you're seeing a play, those sort of things at university develops a moral imagination. You try and imagine yourself in the position of somebody else. So if you see somebody looting in a mall, right, the first instinct maybe is to condemn, but you can also try and imagine what that person might be thinking or what that person's conditions, life conditions might be. And that might lead to a different, I'm not saying that means that you have to justify everything, but it might just lead to a richer understanding of what is going on here. And so I think the sort of education of journalism for me is that education of a sort of imagination, of a moral imagination, and trying to understand things within a broader context. And that's often also a historical context. So, Heather, you mentioned generalization of journalists. How many journalists in newsrooms today can recall, you know, those days that Kamaran referred to, the IFP and the what's happened in during the states of emergency? I mean, do they even know what the states of emergency were? And so when you see now people calling for a state of emergency, do they understand the implications of this? Do they understand the historical ramifications of what it means to send troops into suburbs and townships? So I think that is also important, is that sense of history and that long, the knowledge of the long context. And all of that has to, I think, come into play when you're a journalism or media educator. But I would like to see more of that also happening in practice, where that sort of conversations are happening in terms of how do we understand this current present moment, this hurried history in the context of a much longer social history and political history.
So one of my colleagues, Marianne Tam, one of the grey hairs in the over 60s, two, three weeks ago, set up what we call a political cafe, politics cafe, every Monday at 10 o'clock, because she identified that we would, you know, everyone's talking in circles and we're all working, you know, there's no newsroom because we're all working remotely. And so where younger members of our staff can engage with and talk about what's actually happening in our country. And so everyone can have a view. And it's just an hour. It's an hour from 10 to 11 on a Monday and people do it. It's on Google Meets. But that is a way of, you know, of that intergenerational, you know, sharing of history and understanding and questioning, you know, it's like, and I thought, yeah, that for me, that's a pretty positive move to actually just get that deeper understanding of what are we doing. It's not just getting the story. It's like, you know, what's the, you know, how did we get to where we are now in terms of this context that we're living in?
Please join us in part two of this podcast as we continue our discussion with Heather and Herman.